This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, Kiribati and Fiji set for talks as Sitiveni Rabuka jets off on his first international trip since becoming Prime Minister. Also today, with North Queensland being stricken by floods, we'll hear from a Pacific seasonal worker who's doing it tough.
Now at the moment, because of rain, and we were not working because of rain, and like the area is flood and in paddock is wet, so we cannot do some work.
And we'll find out about a social enterprise that's sailing around Vanuatu's remote islands, delivering health and fitness benefits.
People who choose to live in outlying communities, in remote outstations and things, deserve as best access as possible to governmental services, health and education and others. And that's really what we're trying to aim for here.
All that and more coming up on this morning's program. I'm Nick Fogarty. It's great to have your company. Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka is arriving in Kiribati today, where he'll hold talks with his counterpart Tanesi Maumau. It's Rambuka's first overseas trip since his election last month, in a sign that he views bringing Kiribati back into the Pacific Islands Forum as a top priority. Kiribati left the forum in July last year over discontent with the position of Secretary-General not going to a Micronesian country. Rabuka spoke to reporters in Suva ahead of his trip.
I believe it is very important for the solidarity of the region for them to come back. And we have a very close relationship with Kiribati, particularly with the community on Rambe, originally of Ocean Island.
What will you offer the government of Kiribati?
Nothing. Just get them to come back and we'll work together from there on.
For more on Rabuka's visit, I'm joined now by eKiribati journalist Rimon Rimon. Good morning, Rimon.
Good morning, Nick. How are you doing?
Great, thank you. Now, what reception is Sitiveni Rabuka likely to get in Kiribati?
Oh, well, in general, culturally, and you know, as part of the Kiribati culture, I mean, it's going to be a warm welcome. That is no doubt. We can sense that from how the atmosphere has been here on the ground this week. It's the whole hype is about the visit, and so you know, the government has made that announcement that there will be a national visit to Kiribati. So the whole island is pretty much geared up towards that visit. So there's cleanup campaigns and just beautification of the whole villages, so that when the Sitiveni Rabuka, the Prime Minister of Fiji, arrives in Kiribati, you know, they feels like he's a guest, and that is just typically a Kiribati culture.
So how do you think Tanesi Maumau is going to respond to a request from Fiji to return to the Pacific Islands Forum?
I can't preempt what the talks the outcomes will be. I mean, but I know this is a progress or a step forward in what the Pacific family situation is, and I think it's an act of diplomacy that I think we should have hope that Kiribati government will consider to return into the Pacific family.
And Rabuka has said he isn't going to offer anything. Are there likely to be demands from the Kiribati side to secure its return to the Pacific Islands Forum?
I'm not so sure about demands. I mean, we were aware about the initial unhappiness of the Micronesian countries. I think that has been solved a little bit with all the Micronesians, joining back and signing up to the Suva Agreement. But I think that was just the Kiribati government that was just left on its own. They may have their own reasons. I think we may know that in the coming days. But at this moment, I think that's I'm not sure what Fiji can offer, especially in the capacity on a bilateral level. But I think traveling here on a capacity as a head or chairman of the Pacific Islands Forum, I think that I think it's an act of diplomacy that is appropriate in itself.
When Kiribati did come out of the Pacific Islands Forum in July, what was the reaction there in Kiribati? Was it one of shock?
It was quite mixed reactions on the ground here. Initially, of course, there was a lot of, shock and unhappiness by the people that, we were a part of a sort of like a regional body and now we're not. And this was sort of like reinforced when Kiribati did not attend that summit with the U.S. Later on because it was actually quite made a big issue here in Kiribati, and people were asking why wasn't the Kiribati government not attending that, and the government said simply because they're not part of the forum anymore. So, but there were others who were, still not happy with the issue of the chairmanship and how the Micronesians are treated or getting given that opportunity within the whole Pacific regional body. And, but I think we've gone past that and that's normal as part of a relationship. And I think this trip by Rambuka might mend things and bring us back into the Pacific family, hopefully.
And in the last few months, we've continued to see extreme weather events around the world, which have affected all the Pacific Island nations. Do you think climate change action is something that Fiji and Kiribati will be able to come together on during these talks this week?
I think that is possible, that it has been mentioned by, in interviews with the Prime Minister of Fiji, with the Fiji media. So definitely, I think that's an issue that unites everyone in the Pacific here, especially Fiji has, especially with the previous administration, and I'm not sure with this current administration, but, they've indicated their support to Kiribati, that in case of, the last resort, they could help us, So that's we know that they have our back, and as the Prime Minister mentioned, Kiribati and Fiji share a history because a portion of our Kiribati were dislocated from replaced from our trip to Fiji. So that I think this trip here sort of like reestablishes again that connection that has been, lost.
You're listening to Pacific Beats on Radio Australia. I'm Nick Fogarty, and on the show with me this morning is eKiribati journalist Ramon Ramon, and we're speaking about Fiji's upcoming prime ministerial visit to Kiribati. There's been also a constitutional crisis in Kiribati over the past few months, with the government suspending its High Court and Court of Appeal judges, and then appointing the Attorney General as Acting Chief Justice. Do you think that's likely to come up in talks, and how has that impacted Kiribati's reputation in the region?
I think that has, impacted a big reputation on Kiribati. I mean, we've been following it closely, and some see it as, an arrest on the judiciary arm of the democracy and government in Kiribati. I'm not hopeful that will be part of the agenda. I think that's purely a domestic or sovereign issue for Kiribati to solve by itself or rectify by itself. But I think this visit here is purely as a cordial, trip to try and, mend things and get Kiribati back on board in the Pacific family.
And just generally, how strong are the ties between Fiji and Kiribati?
I can say it's pretty strong. I mean, Kiribati and Fiji, like I mentioned, we share the history of our, some of our people being displaced during the colonial times, being from one of the islands in Kiribati into Fiji, and now they've been there since, the 70s, the 60s. In addition to that, I think the main major is the, tertiary institutions where Kiribati academics go and learn is in Fiji. I mean, Fiji is sort of like a hub, so we share that. Whenever we want to go out of Kiribati, we have to fly out of Fiji first. So these are the kind of things that, make us and Kiribati and Fiji, in such a relationship. And I think this, trip, having the Prime Minister coming over to Fiji, I think that's a good gesture, for a start.
Well, we'll be watching Sitiveni Rambuka's visit to Kiribati closely, and we'll see what plays out there with those issues. So thanks very much for joining us on the program, Ramon.
Thank you for having me, Nick. Good luck.
That's eKiribati journalist Rimon Rimon there. Well, the Fiji Broadcasting Corporation has a whole new board after the resignation of its previous members and chairman. The outgoing chairman, Sashi Singh, had indicated that the board would make way for new appointments to be made by the Ministry of Public Enterprise as Fiji's new government continues to clear the decks in the public service. The FPC resignations come as Sitiveni Rambuka's government begins an investigation into excessive spending patterns in the Department of Information, involving PR company Qorvis, along with local communications company Vartis and FBC itself. A little bit earlier, I caught up with Associate Professor in Journalism at the University of the South Pacific, Dr. Shailendra Singh, who says wholesale change at FBC's board was inevitable.
Whether the board resigned or was pushed, the writing was on the wall. As soon as the new government came into power, the writing was on the wall. You know that this board's days were numbered. Some argue that in Fiji and the Pacific, that historically, you know, the straight broadcaster board appointments are usually political appointments. If this was the case, if such was the case in Fiji, then of course, you know, the old board had to go. You know, when you say that board appointments at the national broadcaster are political appointments, this was more or less confirmed with the new board appointment. This is what some critics are saying. The new board, they are all from the Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka's People's Alliance Party. So what the critics are saying is that it's a lopsided board. However, the new board was appointed before expressions of interest had expired. So they'd called for expressions of interest, you know, to appoint the new board. Before the expressions of interest had expired, the new board was already announced. Government is merely the custodian of FBC, which is a state broadcaster, of course, on behalf of taxpayers. So it is very important that, you know, we get this right and we follow procedures and due process. I think this is the major issue right now with the new board. They are seen as very capable people, but some people, some critics are questioning the process.
Along with handing in their resignations, the previous chair, Sashi Singh, said his board was happy to assist with investigations that would clear any perceived misconceptions about FBC. Aside from, you know, those, I guess, concerns or acknowledgement that they were political appointees, what were those misconceptions about FBC and who held them?
I would say there would be two major misconceptions, as the previous chair put it. If he's talking about misconceptions, then one is that FBC is editorially biased in favor of the previous government, Fiji First. In other words, it is or was against the new government when it was in opposition. Secondly, there are allegations of excessive spending. As to who holds these alleged misconceptions, it's the current government and sections of the public, no doubt. Clearly, the new government feels that FBC is compromised and it holds the previous board accountable. And I think it's for these reasons that the new government is saying that the board must go. Now, you have to remember that many in the current government, they had been in the opposition side since 2014. Now, in those 8 years, they frequently complained that the FBC reported uncritically on the Fiji First government and that FBC either shut out the opposition or reported negatively about them. Now, last year, USP Journalism and Dialogue Fiji, which is an NGO based in Suva, did a content analysis of Fiji's national media coverage of the 2018 elections. And the results indicated that the Fiji First government did receive not only the lion's share of the coverage, but overwhelmingly positive coverage in 5 of the 6 media organizations in Fiji.
The new chair of FBC has been announced as AJ by Amritz. In what direction is he likely to take the board and the broadcaster generally? And is it significant that he said he'll only take a $1 per year director's fee?
Yeah, okay. So Mr. Amrit was reported in the news today as saying he was handpicked by the PM to be the chair of the board, chairperson of the board, because the PM has confidence in him. So Mr. Amrit is one of the founders of the People's Alliance Party, of which the Prime Minister is the leader. And for him to take, to forego the chairperson's allowance is, of course, quite significant. It would be seen as the right gesture for someone, you know, of his status and standing. And, of course, what he has been saying in campaigns. Mr. Amrit, the new chair, has also asked the FBC CEO, Lia Seyed Kayyum, for full financial and capital expenditure reports. And this is from 2008 to 2020 to 2021. Now, as the chair has outlined, FBC receives close to 11 million annually in taxpayer money for public service broadcasting. And he wants to know where and how this money is being used. So Lia Seyed Kayyum, the CEO of FBC, he is the younger brother of the former Attorney General and Communications Minister, A.R. Seyed Kayyum. And because of this, his appointment has always been controversial. But he is refusing to resign, saying that he has done nothing wrong. Now, 11 million, according to Fiji's GDP, Fiji standards, $11 million is a substantial amount of money. But in fairness to FBC and its CEO, FBC is no longer the station it used to be. It's much larger now and much better, many people would argue. It is now a state television broadcaster, in addition to radio, with much better facilities and staff working conditions. And the FBC staff are some of the best paid in the country, as well as the FBC also has an expanded program. You know, so some things are clearly working at FBC, and perhaps some things are not working as they should. And it is the prerogative of the new board, you know, to ask for information and also implement changes if it wants to.
That's Dr. Shailendra Singh, who's an associate professor in journalism at the University of the South Pacific. Work has been halted for Pacific seasonal workers in North Queensland who've been forced to bunker down as extreme levels of rainfall batter the state. Almost 3 months' worth of rain fell over 3 days this week, causing rivers to overflow and supermarket shelves to be stripped bare of supplies. Junior Paul is a fruit picker from Papua New Guinea based in the North Queensland town of Eyre. He told reporter Kyle Evans that several houses have been destroyed and roads to the north and south are being cut off due to flash flooding.
We've been facing almost 2 weeks now. Last week and this week it still continue rain, night, day and night. And some lots of our areas have been blocked because roads have been blocked because of flood. So all the cars, caravan, whatever that go across, they want to go to Bowen. The road have been blocked and now they're just staying in Discovery Park where we live in. Yeah, lots of them. And we've been facing some areas like little floods in where the parks got waters and all this water have been like go through and like come across some houses. And where we live also, it's been like flood and there's water everywhere and under the houses, there's water.
Well, flash flooding has been reported widespread across the region. Now, you're a fruit picker currently based in Eyre, which, for the listeners who don't know, is based about an hour north of the Whitsundays in North Queensland. How long have you been working up there?
Almost 1.5 years now.
And you mentioned that the road's been cut off and everything like that. Have you been able to work during all this rainfall?
Now at the moment, because of rain, and we were not working. Because of rain and like the area is flood and in paddock is wet, so we can do some work.
So what have you and your fellow workers been doing while you've been off work?
We just staying at home. We just sleeping and all this. We got continue rain and.
Have you still being looked after by your employer? You've still got money coming in your bank account and things like that to get supplies?
Yeah, according to our leave, annual leave. Because we were under like PLS, so we still got the annual leave. Yeah, so when we were not work, we still pay under the annual leave.
Speaking of supplies, I've also read that there's some real supply issues at the moment, particularly coming down from Cairns and Townsville and getting supplies through to Eyre and the Whitsunday region where you're currently based. What's it like in supermarkets at the moment? Are the shelves looking pretty bare?
Yeah, like at Woolworths, the supermarket, I went up to Woolworths just in the morning. There's some shortage of some fruits and all these vegetables because of the flood, and there is no transport and all this coming in. So,
going forward, there's talk that it might turn into a tropical cyclone. If that's the case, will you guys just have to continue to be patient until it's all over?
Yeah.
Well, it's good to know. All right, Junior. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, and yeah, good luck up there in the North Queensland floods.
Okay.
That was North Queensland-based fruit picker Junior Paul speaking with reporter Kyle Evans.
Hold the front page!
Time for a bit more Kyle Evans with the latest news headlines from around the Pacific. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Nick. How are you going?
Great, thank you. Starting off, a cyclone warning has been issued in Vanuatu. What's the latest?
Yeah, so a warning was issued in the early hours of last night for Tropical Cyclone Irene, it's called. It's a Category 1 storm, which was located about 280 k's northwest of Tanna. And the Vanuatu meteorology says winds close to the centre were estimated about 80 kilometres per hour. So those gusts are going to affect that area within about 140 nautical miles from the centre of the system. And it's expected to affect the provinces of Tafia and Sheffer from about Thursday night.
So is the cyclone expected to reach landfall?
Yeah, too early to say at this stage. However, the island group is likely to see some heavy rainfall and possible flooding in low-lying areas as it breaks up and gets closer to land.
Well, we'll see how that one develops. Close to 500 allied health professionals have gone on strike this week in PNG. So why is that?
Yes, that's right. So 400 have taken class action, essentially. So this is reported by the Post Courier, and it means no surgeries, cancer treatments, x-rays, dental services, and no medical drugs will be given to patients, basically, until that dispute is resolved in a lot of rural areas of the country. So at the centre of the issue is basically outstanding non-compliance claims, which haven't been paid by the government. Apparently, the government still needs to address something like 12.5 million kina worth of claims there. And according to the Allied Health Workers Association, enough is enough, and they won't work until they've got it.
So how long is that strike likely to last for?
Yeah, unclear as well at this stage. I mean, though, unfortunately, the care needers will no doubt feel the pinch depending how long they're off work. It's worth pointing out that this is the first time the association has gone on strike, so I guess it's pretty new for them as well. So, yeah, look, we'll see how long they can play hardball for, but let's hope it gets resolved soon.
Yeah, more woes for PNG's struggling health system there. And new data out of New Zealand has revealed close to half of Pacific people are living in crowded homes. Is that right?
Yeah, that is. It's an interesting one, this one. So 40% of Pacific people in New Zealand, in fact, are living on top of each other, which is almost four times that of the general population. So this is according to a new report, which is based on the 2018 census, which was then published by RNZ. And it showed nearly 60% of households with Pacific people had more than five residents, but just 4% of those people were actually renting homes with five or more bedrooms. So essentially, there's a lot of room sharing going on, and it seems to be getting worse.
Does the report say why that is?
Numerous things. A lot of families became financially strained during the pandemic. No surprises there. I guess it was one of those situations where even though we were supposed to be social distancing, the financial pressures probably meant more people were living with each other just to save costs. That was later just confounded by, you know, unaffordability of homes and just the rising cost of living in general. But there is a real need to address it because ultimately, you know, overcrowded homes, it's not great for kids. It tends to foster things like truancy in schools, you know, family violence, even health issues like measles and rheumatic fever is prominent among families, particularly in South Auckland.
Yeah, very concerning report there. Thanks very much for bringing us those headlines, Kyle.
Thanks, Nick.
Kyle Evans there with the latest news headlines from around the Pacific region. It's Thursday, January 19, and you're listening to Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. We're already up to week 3 of the new year, and I hope you've all settled in nicely. Still to come on today's show, we'll tell you all about a mysterious boat travelling around Vanuatu delivering supplies and even volleyball lessons. And then we'll also find out why areas designed to protect marine life in the ocean might not be offering as much protection as we thought.
We need to be prepared for the future.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your home or your life isn't.
Cyclone after cyclone, every natural disaster gets worse.
Learn what to do before, during, and after natural disasters in this program aimed at keeping you safe.
I'm a survivor.
Pacific Prepared, Fridays at 8:30 a.m. PNG time here on ABC Radio Australia.
In Vanuatu, over the last 2 weeks, the Helper One boat has been sailing around the outer islands delivering mosquito nets, biosecurity equipment, and volleyball lessons. It's a partnership between social enterprise Respond Global and the Volley for Change campaign, which aims to deliver health and fitness systems to people living in remote areas. Our reporter Jordan Fennell caught up with Respond Global's founder, Dr. Ian Norton, on board the ship at the moment.
What's unique, I suppose, here is this vessel lives and works here in Vanuatu, so she is registered here. The organisation is registered as a not-for-profit here as well, and so this is truly a Pacific-based one. Yeah.
But what was the last 2 weeks like for you personally, and what was the experience like?
Yeah, so I spent 3 months in Vanuatu last year, so it's great to be back. It looks like a second home, really, on board the ship and out in the outer provinces. But we went through Malekula as the Malampa province, then up to Santo and Luganville, right up to the very far north in Torres, and then to the Banks Islands. And then we just come back through Ambai to talk to Penama, and we talked to Sheffer, which is where Port Vila is based, just before we left. What's really great this time is we really managed to get into the day-to-day operation planning for each of those areas. Very health-focused, as I say, in 2022. It's really an important step for us now is to become much wider and look at how we can take a multi-agency approach to serving outlying communities. So I used to work in Darwin for many, many years and really felt strongly that people who choose to live in outlying communities in remote out stations and things deserve as best access as possible to governmental services, health and education and others. And that's really what we're trying to aim for here. So there's a bit of equity. So if you choose to live in an outer island or more remote part of Vanuatu, you get some similar service access.
On the Respond Global Facebook page, it said that the organization is on this particular trip looking to better understand how Helper One can support provincial priorities and activities in 2023. How are you making those determinations about what those provincial priorities are?
So yes, we last year in 2022, it was very much focused on health priorities, and a lot of the discussion that happened in Port Vila at a national level and then providing those programs into the provinces and into the area councils. Now, this time we've had some of those discussions planning for 2023, but we thought it was really important to go and listen to the provinces themselves. So in each of the provinces, and we've just come back from those missions, we met with what they call the PTAC members, so essentially the provincial level council, and then representatives from education, from police, from health, from disaster management, public works, all sorts of different groups in each of the provinces came together, and they held that PTAC meeting on board the vessel, and we brainstormed how the vessel might be used most effectively, and it allowed them a voice about how they'd like the vessel to support them at provincial and even at the area council level.
On this trip, alongside taking health services around the different provinces, you've been joined by the organisation Volley for Change, that's taking volleyball lessons and fitness lessons to people. How did that partnership come about?
Yeah, it was sort of by chance. The planning mission had gone on, but we did have some space on board. And then we heard about the Volley for Change program. Obviously, it's linked to health and to preventing non-communicable disease, so things like diabetes and hypertension through sport and through better healthy lifestyle choices. really resonated with us, talking about diet, about sport, and particularly youth engagement. So we were delighted to offer some space to the Volley for Change team. It was great to see that. They went each day onshore with us as we were organizing. Well, we were dropping off a lot of logistics supplies, so a lot of malaria bed nets and other things went out with us on this program as well. So we delivered those. The Volley for Change team jumped ashore and went and did their thing, particularly talking to community leaders and to youth leaders, and then often a little bit of a practice game and to get people excited and involved, and then sitting everybody down and talking about healthy lifestyle choices. We also carried a biosecurity officer or two, and they were out there trying to check for the rhinoceros beetle, the invasive coconut beetle pest that's not yet there in the Outer Islands, but we want to make sure that we used every opportunity to allow these other agencies to come along. Really, we want to make sure that this is, it feels like a provincial and national-led government project. We're really just supplying the vessel, the logistics, and the marine crew and the operational support, and all the teams that we carry are NIDO.
And how often do you plan this year to go out amongst the provinces and the Outer Islands to deliver those services?
So the full year will be spent here. She's just got to go into a maintenance period for about 5 weeks, but the rest of the time will be spent here. It'll be 36 weeks of day-to-day operations. So starting at the 30th of January, we'll be back out into the provinces, and we'll spend 2 weeks in each province in a round of 12 weeks, then immediately start another round of 12 weeks. All provinces will get an equal amount of time. So 2 weeks there, 2 weeks again in the middle of the year, and then 2 weeks at the end of the year. So the guaranteed recurrent visits means that you can really go out and run a program where you're sure that the officers are going to get back out there 3 times this year, and we're going to deliver a lot of logistic support while we're out there at East. So you can choose what you want on the ship to be carried out to the outer clinics and outer schools and things. It's really to put in place a systemic recurrent visit into outlying access, hard to reach areas.
That was Dr. Ian Norton, the founder of Respond Global in Port Vila, speaking to reporter Jordan Fennell. Earlier in the program, we heard how Pacific seasonal workers are dealing with the North Queensland floods, which are among several flooding events that Australia has had to deal with already in 2023. And it's not just homes, farms and infrastructure that's impacted in these disasters. A new poll is turning attention to the people who've lived through it and the hidden toll on their mental health. Isabel Musali reports.
In early 2020, John Grono and Donna Andrews lost their home in the Black Summer bushfires. They described that first night as brutal, but the years since have been like living in the wilderness.
Over the last 3 years, we've lived in 6 different places, more than I've ever lived in my entire life, and I'm 67. But the people in Bundanoon have been incredibly helpful for us. We've received a lot of support. It's really, really, really tough sort of things to do. And what happens is people, you know, want to help you, but you don't know what you're doing.
The couple's rebuilding in the New South Wales Southern Highlands, but in several ways, it hasn't been easy.
In that period, there are days where you simply can't do anything. It just comes back and bites you, and you've just got to accept that and think, okay, I can do better than that, and that's what you do. And Donna and I both have those days where we're not right, but what we call each other is the rocks. We look at each other and say, are you okay? And the answer's no, and you know, they lift you back up, and you know, Donna's my rock.
A survey conducted by the polling company YouGov and commissioned by the Climate Council has been trying to measure the mental health impact of climate disasters. From a sample of 2,000 people, it found 80% have experienced heat waves, flooding, bushfires, droughts, or other extreme events since 2019. And those in New South Wales and Queensland were the most likely to have experienced multiple disasters. Dr. Simon Bradshaw says more than half of those surveyed saw an impact on their mental health. He's the Climate Council's research director.
So we did expect the results to be quite confronting. But what we found nonetheless was really quite shocking how widespread these challenges are, you know, from the cities to the countries, to the remotest corners of Australia, every state and territory. But it is clear that we need to do so much more as a country to be providing the necessary mental health support and to ensure that people can still thrive in the face of escalating extreme weather disasters.
The poll found Australians have been impacted in a range of ways, from anxiety to depression, PTSD and sleep problems, and 40% reported there wasn't enough mental health support. Mental health organisation Beyond Blue was involved in putting the survey together. Its lead clinical advisor, Dr. Grant Blaschke, says it sends a strong message.
I think this study is telling us that climate change is not just an environmental issue, it's very much a social and a mental health issue as well, and we need to be proactive. So it's great that we can send out mental health services during emergency situations, but what we'd love to see is that we take a step back and be much more planned about it rather than knee-jerk reactions.
He warns these events can have a lasting impact and people need long-term support.
So building the capacity of our mental health system, diversifying the workforce, so that includes everything from mental health first aid when people have just been caught up in an extreme weather event, right through to the specialised mental health services. And not forgetting our GPs.
And with more extreme weather events expected, he says we need to be prepared.
Isabel Musali reporting.
Love sport? Tune in to Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau.
I kid you not, last week in training, one of the scrums collapsed and then I was pulling everyone off. And at the bottom of it was another prop and I genuinely didn't see her face. I'm like, this is just the life of a forward. You just lead these sacrificial, selfless lives. And then you look at the backs, they're playing like duck, duck, goose or something.
Now you're having a crack at the backs.
Yeah, now you got me ramped up.
Can You Be More Pacific? Fridays from 2 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
When it comes to ocean conservation, marine protected areas are seen as the gold standard to protect marine life. In Kiribati, the Phoenix Island protected area is almost 500,000 square kilometres of protected area where commercial fishing is banned. Palau 2 has a similar sized one, and across the Pacific, smaller sized protected areas can be found. But a new scientific study has found that MPAs, as they're commonly called, offer little protection to tuna, which is the region's most lucrative marine resource. Dr. John Hampton is one of the report's authors and is the chief fisheries scientist at the Pacific Islands Community in New Caledonia, and he joins us on the line this morning. Good morning, Dr. Hampton, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, Nick. Nice to be with you.
Jumping straight into the findings, what was the impact of marine protected areas supposed to have on tuna stock numbers?
Well, I think the expectation was that they would have a significant conservation benefit for a range of species, including tunas. We wanted to, through our study, to basically verify what those effects would be for tunas, because implementing MPAs doesn't come without costs. And in the case of the Kiribati, the Phoenix Islands protected area, Kiribati in particular were concerned that having that closed area would detract from their license revenues that they get, which are quite substantial for a country like Kiribati.
So it's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it? You would think the more protected areas, the higher number of tuna, but from this study we see that isn't the case. So why is that?
Okay, well, there are several reasons why MPAs tend not to be that effective for tuna. First, the species that, such as skipjack and big eye tuna, which were the two species that we modelled specifically in our study, they tend not to have spatially discrete spawning areas and spawn very widely throughout the entire tropical Pacific. So it's not really feasible to design an MPA around protecting the spawning areas. You'd basically have to close the entire fishery. Secondly, tunas tend to move around quite a lot, and the MPAs can obviously only protect as long as the fish are inside the MPA, and when they move out, they're subject to fishing pressure again. And thirdly, what we tend to see when MPAs are implemented is that the fishing activity that previously occurred there doesn't simply disappear, but shifts to adjacent areas and continues to fish. So the impacts on the overall stock continue to occur.
So can you take us through how this study was carried out and which area it was done in?
Sure, yeah. We started by modelling, as you said, the contribution to tuna conservation of the Phoenix Islands Protected Area, or PIPA as it's known in Kiribati. and that was implemented in January 2015. So the first thing that our study wanted to do was come up with the quantitative estimates of what the tuna conservation effects of the PIPA are. And we did that by developing spatial models of skipjack and big-eye tuna stocks, two of the more important ones, and then running simulations of the populations, including the historical fisheries, both with and without the PIPA in place. And then comparing those results from the two simulations gives us an estimate of how much protection the PIPA actually gives to the regional stock. As you said in your intro, the PIPA is a large area, about 400,000 square kilometres, but it's still fairly small relative to the range of tuna stocks in the Pacific. So the second thing we wanted to do was to estimate what the conservation outcomes for those same tuna stocks would be for much larger MPAs, hypothetical MPAs comprising around 30% of the area of the Western and Central Pacific. So we ran our simulations for those larger areas as well. In the case of the PIPA, we found that the effect on stock-wide abundance of those two species was essentially insignificant. And then even for the much larger, 30% of the area MPAs, the effects were fairly modest, increasing the overall abundance of skipjack by up to 5% and for big eye up to about 12%. So for the larger areas, the larger the area you have, the more effect you get, but it's certainly not a one-for-one relationship.
You're listening to Pacific Beats on Radio Australia. I'm Nick Fogarty, and on the show with me this morning is Dr. John Hampton, the Chief Fisheries Scientist at the Pacific Community. Kiribati is reopening portions of the Phoenix Island protected area. So can you take us through their experience? I understand they lost income for closing off the area and had little gains in terms of conservation.
Yeah, well, in the case of tuna, Kiribati has been, prior to 2015, licensing particularly purse seine fishing, but also longline fishing that occurred within the PIPA. And that, of course, was prohibited from the 1st of January 2015. Now, the vessels that would have fished there most likely fished in other parts of the Pacific, in particular the high seas areas surrounding the Phoenix Islands. And so when they're fishing in the high seas, they're obviously not generating the same license fees for the Pacific Island countries, and in particular Kiribati. So there was a worry on the part of Kiribati that they were losing out financially on that deal. Now, obviously, the PIPA was meant to do things other than just protect tuna. It's a very interesting and pristine environment with coral reef ecosystems, etc., seamounts, and so I think the protective effects of the PIPA were obviously in place to protect those ecosystems as well, and that they were likely doing that quite effectively.
So if marine protected areas are not the answer for the Pacific, what do you think is the best option for conserving tuna stocks in the region?
Well, I think strengthening fisheries management controls more generally, having responsible effort, responsible limits on overall catch and effort, and we have a multilateral organisation in the Pacific whose job it is to do that. That's the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission. So generally strengthening the monitoring capacity for implementing catch and effort controls and the like are going to be more effective than these sorts of spatial closures in the case of tunas.
And finally, in terms of tuna stocks in the region, how is the Pacific faring generally? Do we still have healthy stocks and therefore lucrative resources for Pacific Island governments?
Yeah, I guess the good news is that the four main tuna stocks, skipjack, big eye, which were the ones that we specifically covered in our study, but also yellowfin and albacore tuna, they're all currently estimated to be fished within sustainable limits and so can continue to generate the sorts of financial benefits that are substantial for Pacific Island countries.
Well, some very important research happening there on a very important industry for the Pacific, and we will look forward to hearing more about that in the future. Thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Hampton.
Thanks, Nick. It was my pleasure.
Dr. John Hampton, Chief Fisheries Scientist at the Pacific Community SPC. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat for this morning. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time, and you'll have Richard Hewitt with the Friday Sports Edition. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next. I'm Nick Fogarty. Thanks for your company.